This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Kelly Garib.
Andrew Finn McGill comes from a musical family in North Carolina. Finn McGill studied traditional Irish and old-time bluegrass at the Swan Noah Gathering, a traditional music workshop series held each July and August at Warren Wilson College in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains. McGill is a Fulbright Fellow, South Arts Emerging Traditional Artist, and North Carolina Arts Council Fellow, as well as an All-Ireland Fiddle Finalist. McGill has brought traditional fiddle music to audiences across the country and the world, and he presented a 6:30 evening concert on September 6, 2023, to an audience at Shepherd University. We are happy to have Andrew Finn McGill with us today on Voices from Appalachia. Welcome to the show, Andrew Finn McGill. So your training is in both classical and traditional violin. How did you develop your interest and begin to study traditional fiddle music?
Well, my training is mostly just through the local music community of Asheville, North Carolina. So I did take classical violin lessons for a year, maybe, but both of my parents play traditional Irish music. So from day one, I was learning traditional Irish music simultaneously with classical Suzuki. I was never interested in the classical lessons. You know, my mom tells these stories how she basically had to pay me to practice. It was like pulling tooth and nail. But then once I discovered Irish music, she basically had to pay me to stop practicing. She'd be like yelling down the stairs, "Finn, it's time for dinner," and I just wouldn't come up. Later in life, I've developed more of an interest for the written page, we'll say. You know, I could always read music because of Suzuki and doing choir all through middle school and high school, but like I would say in the last 10 to 15 years, I've become a lot more interested in classical music and other kinds of music that aren't oral in the way that Irish or old time are.
So when did you first pick up the violin?
I was 10 years old. Yeah, and then I evidently, again, I also just heard this from my mom. It was when I was 11 that I really became obsessed, like practicing 6 hours a day and that kind of thing.
That's a lot for an 11-year-old.
Yeah, I guess it's a lot to do anything at that age because we have such short attention spans.
And so they, both of your parents played music. Do they also play violin or?
My dad owned a fiddle. I don't know if even he would have ever called himself a fiddle player. He taught me my first fiddle tune, which was a Scottish tune. Maybe I'll play it tonight at the lecture. But yeah, my dad is primarily a guitar player and a mandolin player. And then my mom plays the wooden flute and tin whistle.
And so they just wanted to round out their group of instruments with you on the fiddle?
Well, it's funny. I'm actually named after a famous Irish fiddle player, Andy McGann. And so my first name is Andrew. And so, you know, Andy McGann, Andy McGill was my dad's thinking. I mostly go by my middle name, so I guess the joke's on him. But yeah, I mean, my dad always kind of had fantasies of me playing Irish music specifically and being a musician, because he was a full-time musician all throughout the 80s. And so he did his best to surround me with music and ensure that I would pick it up too.
You have classes and workshops and the lecture series, and you teach people to play the fiddle as well?
Yeah, well, let's see, the lecture series, as in what I'm doing tonight?
Yeah.
Yeah, so a few years ago, I started giving, I think lecture is kind of a dirty word, let's call it a presentation.
Okay.
So I started giving this presentation a few years ago on the relationships between Irish and Scottish fiddle music and American fiddle music. And the inspiration for that was my dad started something called the Swan Noah Gathering, which is a series of music workshops. And so as a kid, I got to take classes at all of them, but mainly the Celtic Week and the Old Time Week. So I was learning both of these kinds of music all throughout my teenage years, and eventually noticed, like a lot of people do, that there are a lot of similarities in the tunes, like the melodies themselves would, you know, be very similar, sometimes the same melody, or the types of tunes were similar. And, you know, for years I just noticed this and didn't do anything about it. But a few years ago I decided to actually put together this presentation, and which is what I'll be giving tonight here at Shepherd University, to show people the differences and just explore a little bit about how this Irish and Scottish music morphed when it got here. So that is the lecture slash presentation that I've been giving the last few years, you know, here and there at universities and museums. It's not a regular thing, unfortunately. And then I have a handful of private students, which is ever changing in number and frequency, mostly because I'm a full-time touring musician, so that's what takes up most of my time. But I do a fair bit of fiddle camps in the summer. I'm actually wearing a t-shirt to one of them, the Kaufman Camp in Tennessee. Fiddle camps, for our listeners that don't know, are basically like the Swannanoa Gathering in that they are music workshops where you take classes during the day, and then at night there's dances, jam sessions, concerts, various things like that. And there are dozens of fiddle camps all over the country, if not world, and they almost all happen during the summer. So my summer is typically split between touring and like touring festivals, gigs, that kind of thing, and then these fiddle camps.
Okay. So your dad started the Swannanoa camp.
Yeah, so Doug Orr, the president emeritus of Warren Wilson College in Asheville, North Carolina, used to go to the Augusta Heritage workshops here in West Virginia. And so when he got the job as president of Warren Wilson, he wanted to start something similar at Warden Wilson. So he hired my dad to build it. That was 1990.
And so you attended these as a youth and teen. Do you still attend them?
I do, yeah. In fact, these days as of last year, I'm the coordinator of Fiddle Week. So that's kind of a new managerial role for me, kind of a new role in a lot of ways. But for many years, I've taught at the Celtic Week. Not every year, but the Celtic Week and Fiddle Weeks.
When you're not teaching at the weeks, do you still go as a participant? Or
if I'm not on tour, yeah. I mean, it's a lot of fun.
So you go to a lot of fiddle camps throughout the summer, if you can. Why? Like, what's important about going to all of these different camps?
Well, I go if I get asked to teach. I haven't been a participant, a student at one, in a very long time. But yeah, I think it's important to pass this music on to the next generation, and these fiddle camps seem to be the most popular way to do that for traditional music these days. It seems to be that's where a lot of young people are meeting their peers also interested in this music and forming bands and things like that. Not just there, fiddlers conventions and festivals too, but there's so many of these fiddle camps, and some of them have become so well executed, so organized. Yeah, they're really fun, and you know, and you can study with some of the best fiddlers in the world. But I think, you know, whether it's the teacher or the student, I think the most important part is that exchange, because just playing the music is what's going to keep it alive, and it's a great space to do that.
To tie in a little bit with your presentation tonight, so many of these Appalachian musical traditions, as well as the dialect and customs of Appalachia, are connected directly to Scotland and Ireland, as well as to African and Italian traditions and people who immigrated to the region to work in the mines and mills of Appalachia. Mm. One could even argue that American popular music evolved in the 1920s and 30s from Appalachian musical traditions. Why do you think it was so important for early settlers in the region to bring over these popular musical ballads and traditions when they immigrated to the region?
Well, I think it was a lifeline to their culture. I mean, almost none of these people came here because they wanted to. They were forced to for various reasons. I think when you're exiled from your home, or even if you're voluntarily exiling yourself because of persecution or no opportunity or whatever it is, music is such a way. Music and language are like, and I guess food. There are a few, but music is certainly a big one in keeping that culture alive and keeping that connection to where you came from. And so, I mean, if you look at like the most predominant influences in traditional Appalachian music, African, Ireland, Scotland, these were all incredibly oppressed peoples. And so it would make sense that they would bring their music with them, and they would cling to that so fiercely, because that's something that people can't take away. The people over there can take away their land and livelihoods, but they can't take away their music.
So you talked a little bit about how you're mainly a touring artist. Mm-hmm. And being on the road can't be terribly easy. How do you manage touring and recording and family duties and just living your life?
Yeah, that is a great question. It seems to be like a roller coaster in that some days are easier than others, some weeks are, some months are, some years are collectively. When I step back and look at the year, I, like for example, today is the first day of a 3-week tour that I'm on, pretty much nonstop. But I didn't have any gigs for like a week before this. And then when I get home, I don't think I have any gigs for 5 days, but I'm always in work mode. So the big challenge to me has been, there are certain things that I refuse to give up. You know, I am a workaholic by nature, and I really have to check myself, because sometimes, especially before I had a daughter, I would just be working all the time. And in so doing, you know, I wouldn't be spending time with friends or reading or running, which are all things that are important to me, or even practicing my instrument. You know, I strive to practice 3 hours a day. So, you know, I've gone through various phases of like 8-hour work days, 4 hours practice, 4 hours admin, 4 hours booking. But all of that has been thrown out the window now that I have a daughter. And just like life has gotten so much more complicated now with like, I don't know, somehow it just has. So it's a constant challenge to get the most out of those 3-4 hours of booking. So I really make a point to practice every day. I always shoot for 3 hours. I can't get 3 hours, that's fine, but at least I practice some. And then I do some booking. The hourage almost doesn't matter as long as I'm doing all of the things, which are playing my instrument, booking / admin, spending time with my daughter, and exercise, which I don't do every day. But yeah, it's a real challenge, and I'm constantly fine-tuning it. And like some things that I do just to make, like we don't have a TV at my house, and like I haven't willingly watched a TV in probably 15 years. I don't scroll on social media. I get in and out, I check, see if I have any messages. No? Okay. X out the window. So little things like that that just collectively free up that 30 minutes to practice or whatever it is.
Are you excited for when your daughter's old enough to maybe understand what the fiddle is and learn how to play it?
Do you think you'll... Yeah, well, she already kind of gets it. Like, we bought her a little fiddle, and she'll get it out and imitate me, you know. But yeah, like, at this point, it's just for a laugh, you know. Mm-hmm. But we'll see in 2 years, you know. I'm going to do what my parents did to me, which is just surround her with the music, all the right stimuli, and then hopefully she'll be inspired to do it.
Your parents taught you, and they play a plethora of musical instruments. Do you guys play as a group ever, or is that kind of not in the cards?
Well, my parents didn't really teach me, but my dad did teach me my first tune, but where I really learned was in the Irish session of the Irish musical community of Asheville, North Carolina in the late 90s, early 2000s, but then also going to the Swarnoa Gathering every year, because it's 5 weeks. So that was a long period of time where I could just immerse myself in Appalachian music and Irish music, etc. We used to have like a family band when I was a teenager, but there was too much drama. The band broke up. Family didn't, but the band did. So yeah, we as a family play maybe once every 4 years now. But a lot of that is just because of our lifestyles too. And my parents are, you know, frankly, they're older and they're more interested in other things. They have other hobbies. Music has become a little bit more of a hobby for them, you know, instead of like a career as it used to be.
So you have recorded multiple albums, and they're mm-hmm. inspired by cultures and musical traditions around the globe. Could you tell us about your albums, how they came about, the kind of music, and where you find new inspiration? Or how you find new things to want to record?
Sure. So most of my albums are either traditional Irish music or Brazilian music, mm-hmm. actually, because I lived in Brazil for a few years. But then I have recorded a few albums which you couldn't categorize in either one of those things. But all of them have to do with like just my life, you know, where I've lived and the musicians I was around. So for example, I lived in Malawi for a year and I recorded an Afropop album. Wrote and produced an Afropop album with a musician from there. I did a Kickstarter to do a concept called Roots and Branches. So the Roots album is all traditional music, but the Branches is all originals. Some of it's sounding more Irish and or American than other tracks. And rifling through the albums in my brain here, there's like 10 or 11 of them. There's a new one coming out, which is probably the truest to who I think I am as a person, because I don't just do Irish and Brazilian music. You know, I play Appalachian and I play jazz, Jazz is a huge part of my life, has been since I was 14. So this new project is, in many ways, a jazz album. All the musicians on it are trained jazz musicians, and, you know, the tunes are like templates for improvisation to a large degree in the way that jazz is. And that's probably where I find my most inspiration is in that world, you know, is in the jazz world, simply because so much of it is about pushing the boundaries musically, which I really dig. But I find musicians who have like a similar relationship with music across genres. So, you know, I can be just as inspired by like a great traditional Irish musician too. But in terms of my own writing and my own albums, it seems in recent years it's been coming more from that world. Modern instrumental music, Brazilian jazz, things like that.
How did you get to Brazilian music from North Carolina? It's a little bit outside the kind of realm of the rest of it.
I suppose it is. It's a fair question. Well, basically, it was a girl. My wife is from Brazil, and so when I met her, I went to Brazil to learn Portuguese in 2014, and then I met her while I was there, and so we fell in love, and I moved to Brazil, lived there 2 years. And it was when I moved there that I decided to start learning music from there, because wherever I go, I try to like learn some music from that region, just, you know, to expand my horizons and more tools in my toolbox. But the Brazilian one really stuck. That really became an obsession. I just, for some reason, am fascinated by that music. Yeah, and so I don't know how much Irish music prepared me for that, or Appalachian music, but the jazz did. I mean, I had been studying jazz before that, and there are some similarities in the way like the harmonies work. Some similarities in instrumentation to saxophones, clarinets. But that's how I wound up in Brazil. Does that make sense?
No,
satisfactory answer?
Yeah, makes perfect sense. And so, where do you all live now?
We live in Asheville.
Okay.
Yeah, we've been back for 6 years now, almost seven.
And so Asheville is really big as a kind of a hub of traditional music and like Appalachian culture. Was that important in your decision to settle down there?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge, it's one of those things, you know, when you take it for granted when you're there, but when you're away from it, you really miss it. And when I was in Brazil, I definitely missed it. And, you know, we moved back. As soon as we moved back, I hit the ground running as a touring musician. And then the pandemic came along. So I feel like I'm only now kind of getting back into the scene, but there's some really great players out there, and I'm organizing an old-time jam at my house actually next month, just because there's so many great players, and I haven't been to like a rockin' jam in a long time. Not in Asheville, that is, but yeah, so I mean, I try to make a point to go as much as I can, but you know, it's hard with, I'm away 6 months of the year, and then when I'm home, there's just so much to do, it's like, it gets a little overwhelming.
What's a typical year, like touring-wise schedule? Is it usually throughout the summer or the winter, or does it kind of...
Well, historically, I've done some sort of tour every month. If I had any month off, historically, it was September, which we're recording this on September 5th, 6th? 6th?
6th, yeah.
Yeah, so... And here I am embarking on a 3-week tour, so I've broken my rule. But yeah, I think, I mean, I do enjoy it. And I figured out there's a certain way to tour so that you can tour every month of the year if you want. And as of now, I've wanted to, but I am looking to scale back a little bit in the coming years for various reasons. But yeah, I mean, there are like certain cycles, like, you know, the summer, there's a lot more festivals and music camps, like I said. And so the gigs change, you know, like December is almost all holiday gigs, you know, a lot of churches, and, you know, because it's Christmas, so like gigs like that. January and February, I tend to find myself like in the Gulf, or I'm going to California in February to do a tour. Places where the gigs won't get canceled if there's inclement weather, because there isn't inclement weather in New Orleans in February. In theory.
Yeah. Not as inclement as it would be in New England.
Exactly. Which I learned the hard way.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm going back to New England, too, in February, so wish me luck.
Well, hopefully the snow is light.
Yeah.
I know. So, You have musical connections, it seems, across the globe at this point, but with strong musical connections to Ireland and Scotland, this is kind of your original basis. How have you and your music been received traveling abroad? You playing Scottish music or Irish music in Ireland or Scotland, or kind of reinventing some Brazilian music in Brazil?
Yeah, I mean, I've only ever had positive reception from it, and like when it's been negative, it hasn't been negative. Like negative means like maybe a low turnout at the gig or people aren't that interested in it. I don't think it's necessarily because I'm an American. I think it's because just like even in Ireland, you know, people my age would probably rather go hear a rock concert than hear a traditional artist. You know, that's the way here. That's the way it is here with traditional American musician. But yeah, I mean, one thing that I always try to do, when I've been to those places, it's always been with musicians from those places, be it Brazil, Ireland, or Scotland. And it's not necessarily to ensure that I have like a stamp of approval or legitimacy, because look, I'm playing with an Irish person. It's just because the experience is more meaningful to me to play it with people who know that culture and speak that language really well. And so that has made the tours pretty enjoyable. Yeah. I think at this point I'm much more interested in going over there and playing American music. You know, I think that might actually, I don't know, at least the crowds might be bigger. I'll tell you that.
Is there another country that you have your eye on to go next to kind of immerse yourself in their music?
To immerse myself in their music? Yeah, well, France would be the next one. I mean, I've been to France many times, specifically to the northwest of France, Brittany, but I love Breton music and culture, and I would love to learn a lot more about that. I actually recorded an EP last year with a Breton musician. Every time I work with a Breton musician, I'm reminded of how deep this culture is and how much there is to learn. So yeah, I would love to go over there and plunge into that.
Did you want to play anything for us for the recording?
Yeah, we have time. Okay, here's a tune I learned recently. It's from Southwest Virginia called Sal's Poor Gal. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Does that work?
That works cool. Perfect. Thanks for agreeing to be interviewed.
Yeah, of course. Well, thanks for good work. Thanks for preparing.
To end the show, we'll listen to a recording from the Shepherd University Appalachian Heritage Festival, which brings live performances and workshops to the campus and community every September. Here's the State Birds performing Blue-Eyed Gal. Thank you. that was the State Birds performing Blue Eyed Gal. Thanks again to Andrew Finn McGill for being on our show today. I'm Kelly Garib, and this has been Voices from Appalachia.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. Music is provided by Appalachian artist, singer, activist, and scholar Flora Meeker, with the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia, Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/appalachian or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd.